Hey there, kindred spirits. Welcome to the podcast where three grown-ass ladies geek out about Anne of Green Gables. I'm Kelly Gerner, and I'm here with my co-host Reagan Duffy and our special guest, Kelly Tager. Hi, Kelly.
Hello.
Hello, kindred spirits. So just as proof that kindred spirits are really everywhere, we know Kelly because my daughter Alice and Kelly's daughter Clara are in Girl Scouts together, but we only recently found out about Kelly's deep love of Anne of Green Gables, and most exciting of all, we found out that Kelly narrated the audiobook of The Blue Castle. So welcome to the pod, Kelly.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
This really does feel like we have a celebrity in our midst.
A little bit.
So Kelly Tager is an award-winning audiobook narrator and voice actor. After earning her master's in Shakespeare studies in the UK, we definitely need to know more about that. She worked in theater and TV and film for years until discovering she preferred working behind the mic. Her favorite genres to narrate include literary fiction, women's fiction, rom-coms, and contemporary romance, which I think very neatly dovetails with our reading interests. So well done.
You're welcome. No problem.
This year, you can find her signing at the romance conventions Wild and Windy in Chicago and Rare in Edinburgh, Scotland. You can also hear her voice in various commercials and in the English dubbing of various shows on Netflix and Hulu. She lives in LA with her husband, two daughters, and a dog. So Kelly is, of course, a massive Anne fan. In college, she wrote an acting exercise using an Anne moment that ended up being published in her acting professor's book. You're going to have to tell us what moment that was.
Oh, yeah, I will.
Okay. She also walked down the aisle to the soundtrack from Anne of Green Gables, the sequel. And that is the commitment to Anne that we love to see. And then, of course, Kelly also produced and narrated an audiobook version of The Blue Castle, which is available on Audible, Amazon, iTunes, all the platforms. You guys, it is so good. Do yourselves a favor and listen to it. Okay, Kelly, what was your acting exercise?
Oh, so the acting exercise was actually not from the book. It was from the movie, the miniseries. You have to do a silent moment where there's no dialogue, when it's just a quiet moment by yourself.
Okay.
So I did the one she finds the mouse in the pudding.
That's yes. A great scene. That's a great scene. And then it's just like all the emotions pass over her face, right? Mm-hmm. Like the horror and shock and disgust. And then like, what am I going to do? Am I going to be deceptive? Am I going to be honest? Like, how am I going to take care of this? Mm-hmm. That's amazing.
Mm-hmm. Coming up with a plan, all that stuff. Yep. Yeah, it was great because my acting professor was writing an acting book. She goes, if you give me an exercise, I will put it in there. So I think I've got it somewhere. But I was like, I will forever be associated with Ellen Montgomery. And just to seal the deal, I did Blue Castle. So yeah.
I love it. That's amazing. Well, kindred spirits, today we are going to be talking about all the romance in Anne's House of Dreams. But first, before we dive in, we would love it if you all got to know Kelly a little bit better. So tell us how you came to love Anne of Green Gables.
Well, I first read the series, I believe it was in fifth grade, and I liked it, but I did not love it. Mm-hmm. I was a little too young to fully appreciate everything about it. But even though I did love the miniseries, that was kind of my gateway. But then I reread the series when I got to eighth grade and was completely addicted, obsessed with it, and clearly have not broken that addiction. Because I remember in eighth grade, ninth grade, I would just read all the romantic little bits between Anne and Gilbert's interactions, you know, through the first 1 through 6 and just swoom every time.
Totally. Same. Those are like all the parts that are like underlined and dog-eared in my childhood versions as well.
Yep. Totally. I figured I would not be alone on this one. They'd be like,
not even a little bit.
You found your people. Here we are.
Thank you.
So, Kelly, I know you recently started reading Anne with your oldest daughter, Clara. How did she like it? What was that experience like?
It was kind of crazy. She was a little like, at first, because it's Marilla and Rachel at first. But so it's a little slow going for an 11-year-old nowadays. But once we got from Anne's point of view, it was smooth sailing. And my favorite was hearing her complete freakouts during the slate scene. And then at the ending, when they finally mend their friendship. I mean, literally, I think the sound she made was the equivalent of Like, I couldn't actually continue because I had to wait for her to stop screaming at the end.
Yep.
She was writhing on the floor during the slate. It was amazing.
That's so funny.
And I was thinking, like, these scenes still hold power.
There's something in that moment when Anne brings down that slate on Gilbert's head that 100 years later, just every single time it hits, it just, like, you're like, yes.
Literally. It's just satisfying, you know? It's just satisfying.
It really is. Well, let's bring it back over this way. And we wanted to know a little bit about how you got into your fascinating career as an audiobook narrator.
Well, I did theater and film for years. And I loved theater. Film never felt like a really great fit for me. But then I discovered voiceover. And that I was like, where have you been all my life? And it felt like a given to just do audiobook as well, because that's one big section of voiceover, because I loved reading. And it takes definitely a certain type of temperament to sit in a padded room all day and talk to yourself in different voices. It's a lot more work than people think usually, but it's also some of the most rewarding work that you'll ever do. And I love the collaboration between when the author is happy with your words, it's just magical. And when you feel like you're a good fit for that part, it's awesome. What I love about audiobooks is you get to play all the parts. You don't have to, typecast is like, oh, well, you look like this, so you're going to play this. No, it's you play everything and it's awesome. So
it sounds like such a fun and creative thing to do, but it also sounds incredibly hard. I think I'd have trouble just keeping all the voices straight.
It depends. I mean, I always have a movie kind of going on in my head. So if you're connected to the book, it's easy because you just know what that character sounds like. You know, it's like, you know what your dad sounds like, you know what your kid sounds like, you know, it's that kind of thing. So yeah, I mean, if you're coming back to a series like I'm doing right now that I haven't done in a year, then I'm like, whoa, what did they sound like again? And that's right. Why you keep little snippets. But what sometimes people don't realize, I mean, I get asked all the time do you read the book beforehand? I'm like, no, I like to figure out who did it in a mystery along with you guys. I'm like, and then the butler did it. You're kidding. Like, I mean, I'm like, come on.
That's and amazing. We need to be like, the what? Wait a minute.
I was like, are you reading like, that? That's a weird choice. I can't believe that happened.
You need to know the arc of the story, you know, and you also need to know what accents to do.
Yeah, definitely.
Because if you read on page 200 that suddenly they mention that southern drawl that they never mentioned before, and you haven't read that book before, you're screwed, let me tell you.
Wait a minute, this is all happening in Scotland? Whoa.
Yeah.
Exactly right.
I had no idea. Like,
I'm so glad we got some of your Scottish accent there.
Amazing work. Well, you know what? We're going to come back and at the end and our Birch Path, and we want to talk to you more about being an audiobook narrator and all of your work. So let's put a pin in it right here, and we are definitely going to come back because I can't wait to learn more. So as our listeners know, there's always a theme of romance in the Anne stories. As a young girl, Anne was enamored with the idea of romance, but she didn't give much thought as it applied to herself, preferring to play act and write stories about it. And then in Anne of Avonlea, Anne was enchanted by Miss Lavendar's storybook, Second Chance Romance, but clearly not ready for romance herself or for those close to her, as her reaction to Diana's engagement showed us. In Anne of the Island, Anne had to confront the tension between her ideals of romance with the way that romance showed up in her real world, fending off unromantic proposals, trying on her romantic ideal in Roy Gardner, and eventually facing up to the truth that she had been avoiding for years, that she is in love with her good friend, Gilbert Blythe. Anne of Windy Poplar shows us snippets of Anne's engagement to Gilbert through her letters, but mostly we see Anne meddling in the romances of others now that her romance is nice and settled. So, question for the two of you, which Anne is more infuriating? The Anne who dodges Gilbert all through Anne of the Island, or the meddling Anne of Anne of Windy Poplars?
Okay, for me, it's meddling Anne, which, by the way, I like meddling Anne. I mean, we had a lot of fun talking about Windy Poplars. We had a lot of fun talking about how Anne's always up in everyone's business. But I find that a more infuriating choice, maybe on Maud's part, because it doesn't really seem particularly earned or consistent with Anne's character overall. Not to say that she never got involved in sort of the intrigues of her friends and neighbors before, but that wasn't like her reason for being. Meanwhile, I think that the sort of frustrating push-pull of her relationship with Gilbert, the will they or won't they in Anne of the Island, that is frustrating, but it is so earned comparatively. We really understand where she's coming from. And that feels pretty real to me and like consistent with both her character and then just sort of young adulthood generally. So I like both Annes. But I think that Wendy Poplar's Anne is more infuriating, to answer your question, Reagan.
I agree with your rationale, Kelly. I think it is a little more out of character, and like you can kind of justify it by saying, well, she wants everyone else to be happy. Mm. But and I do think the waffling is more earned, but the waffling is what infuriates me more. Because I'm like, just freaking come on, the boy's been waiting for I just want to shake her. So I feel like she has gone so hot and cold with him for so long, and I'm just not looking at everyone else and look inside yourself, you know,
look
like,
inside yourself. Like,
but that's
know
what
thyself.
I love. You're just like, it took you so long, but thank you. You're like, so I do feel it's earned, but at the same time it's just like, because she has made the choice, I believe that it's going to finally stick. But it's so frustrating to go with her on that process when you're just rooting for him the whole time. So, yeah.
Absolutely. I side with you on that one, just in terms of like the emotional roller coaster that she takes you on, where every time she starts kind of catching that glimpse of what's happening, she like backs away from it and how everyone else can see it, but she's so steadfast in it. And it's just this emotional roller coaster where I always feel emotionally wrung out by the end of it. But luckily for us, in Anne's House of Dreams, we finally get to see Anne's romance fulfilled. Yes, hurrah. You know, one of the things we love about House of Dreams is that's something we don't often get to see in other romance. Right? In other romance books, we don't often get to see what happens next. Once the boy gets the girl, once the wedding vows are said, what does it look like to live in the ever after part of the happily ever after?
So it wouldn't be a book about romance without Gilbert Blythe as our kindred spirit of the episode. Obviously, we are all huge Gilbert fans around here, but getting to see him in his marriage to Anne is something special. Seeing the way he cares about Anne, specifically Anne, right, is a fulfillment of all that we've wished for the two of them as a couple. Gilbert has really grown into himself in this book, and we get to see him up close far more than any other book. He gets to talk more. He's just on the page more. We see his dedication to his career, to his patience, his ethics. We see his sharp mind as he spars with Captain Jim and Miss Cornelia. And we see his tenderness with Anne and the way he values her thoughts and opinions, even when they disagree. Gilbert as a husband is everything we wished for Anne and everything he's ever wanted for himself. Kelly, would you please do us the honor of reading our quote of the episode for us?
Sure. This quote comes from an evening shortly into their marriage when Anne and Gilbert are walking back to the House of Dreams from Captain Jim's lighthouse. "How the home lights shine out tonight through the dark," said Anne. "That string of them over the harbor looks like a necklace. And what a coruscation there is up at the glen. Oh, look, Gilbert, there is ours. I'm so glad we left it burning. I hate to come home to a dark house. Our home light, Gilbert, isn't it lovely to see? Just one of Earth's many millions of homes, Anne girl. But ours, ours, our beacon in a naughty world. When a fellow has a home and a dear little red-haired wife in it, what more need he ask of life?"
That was so good. I can see why you're an award-winning narrator. We are going to make you read all the major quoted passages in this episode, okay? And our listeners are going to have a hard time going back to just us reading quotes in future episodes.
Sorry.
We're setting the bar high. Everyone. Well, let's get into our story club. Not only do we have the fulfillment of Anne and Gilbert's love story, we have the romance arc between Owen and Leslie, and the frequent contrast between Anne's contentment and Leslie's bitterness. And we have a surprise wedding for Miss Cornelia to give us a trifecta of romances. We start the book with Anne and Gilbert preparing for their wedding. Gilbert has been looking for a house for the two of them in Four Winds Harbor, where Gilbert will be taking over his great uncle's medical practice. Everyone at Green Gables is preparing for the wedding, And we get a lot of little callbacks in those first few chapters of Anne's journey, symbolizing that one chapter of her life is closing and a new one is opening. And it also illustrates the way this book is a bridge in the Anne series between the first four books, which are about Anne's growth arc, her childhood through young adulthood, and the last three books, which focus on Anne's children, and in which Anne is more and more a background character. Her growth arc is primarily completed. We first get to see Gilbert when he returns from Four Winds to tell Anne about the house that he has found for them. And as befits our nature child, Anne, they talk about their future under the birches by the brook. Gilbert tells Anne he found a little house close to the harbor, a little out of the way of the village, as Anne was hoping for. The house is fully furnished, and though the house and its furnishings are old-fashioned, everything is in good repair and well-built. And it's to Gilbert's practical nature to lead with that. But then Maud writes,
"So far good," said Anne, nodding cautious approval. "But Gilbert, people cannot live by furniture alone. You haven't yet mentioned one very important thing. Are there trees about this house?" "Heaps of them, Dryad. There is a big grove of fir trees behind it, two rows of Lombardy poplars down the lane, and a ring of white birches around a very delightful garden. Our front door opens right into the garden, and there is another entrance, a little gate hung between two firs. The hinges are on one trunk and the catch on the other, their boughs from an arch overhead. Oh, I'm so glad. I couldn't live where there are no trees. Something vital in me would starve. Well, after that, there's no use asking if there's a brook anywhere near. That would be expecting too much. But there is a brook, and it actually cuts across one corner of the garden." "Then," said Anne with a long sigh of supreme satisfaction, "this house you have found is my house of dreams and none other."
I really love it. The really swoony thing about this whole scene is how clearly Gilbert knows Anne and how he found the perfect house for her, his bride. You know, after all these years of yearning for her, observing her, working hard to better himself, to be worthy of her, he now shows his love by knowing exactly the kind of home she wants. And even though it's a little out of the way for the town doctor, Gilbert's focus at this moment is making this perfect for Anne. And it's that quiet, steady knowing and appreciation of Anne that has always made Gilbert our favorite romantic hero. It's not in the poetry Anne had wished was written to her, or the grand gestures or spectacular settings. It's the way he loves her for exactly who she is.
I feel like it's the old-fashioned equivalent of the guy knowing exactly how she takes her coffee.
Totally, right?
You know? In every romance novel and movie, it's always cream, two sugars, right? How does he know?
It's because he notices and he's observing and he's paying attention. And I think that is always part of the romantic fantasy, right? So this is someone who's so in tune with you and your desires that he just understands these things. Yeah. And, you know, it's a perfect example for Gilbert. The night before their wedding, Gilbert walks Anne back to Green Gables from Matthew's grave. This is a clear callback to that first walk they took as friends when Anne thanked Gilbert for giving up the Avonlea school for her and apologized for not forgiving him long ago. The two of them also feel this symmetry. And they acknowledge it in this really lovely scene that just shows how intimately connected they are.
"History repeats itself," said Gilbert, joining her as she passed the Blythe Gate. "Do you remember our first walk down this hill, Anne? First walk together anywhere, for that matter? I was coming home in the twilight from Matthew's grave, and you came out of the gate, and I swallowed the pride of years and spoke to you. And all heaven opened before me," supplemented Gilbert. "From that moment, I looked forward to tomorrow. When I left you at your gate that night and walked home, I was the happiest boy in the world. Anne had forgiven me. I think you had the most to forgive. I was an ungrateful little wretch. And after you had really saved my life that day on the pond, too, how I loathed that load of obligation at first. I don't deserve the happiness that has come to me." Gilbert laughed and clasped tighter the girlish hand that wore his ring. Anne's engagement ring was a circlet of pearls. She had refused to wear a diamond. "I've never really liked diamonds since I found out they weren't the lovely purple I had dreamed. They will always suggest my old disappointment." "But pearls are for tears, the old legend says," Gilbert had objected. "I'm not afraid of that. And tears can be happy as well as sad. My very happiest moments have been when I had tears in my eyes. When Marilla told me I might stay at Green Gables, when Matthew gave me the first pretty dress I ever had, when I heard that you were going to recover from the fever, So give me pearls for our troth ring, Gilbert, and I'll willingly accept the sorrow of life with its joy. But tonight, our lovers thought only of joy and never of sorrow, for the morrow was their wedding day, and their house of dreams awaited them on the misty purple shores of Four Winds Harbor.
Okay, this is such a treat getting to have Kelly read for us. I'm like getting misty eyed just listening to this.
I know.
It's so wonderful.
It makes it feel so alive.
Yes. Right? Oh my gosh. Thank you so much for sharing your talent with us.
This is as close as I can ever get to Gilbert. So I'm really happy to be here. Yes. Because I'll never get to marry him. So, like, you know.
I know. Well, and we never get to see these moments on the screen the way that so many of our favorite Anne of Green Gables moments were done so well in the 1985 miniseries.
Yeah.
Like so many of those moments were done just gorgeously and perfectly. But one of our major complaints about Anne of Green Gables, the sequel, is so much of what we love about Anne of the Island and some of these other moments is that we don't get to see, and I've always been sad, and this is almost I can almost picture it as you're reading it.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, one of the lovely things about this section with this walk between Anne and Gilbert is there's so many touchstones and foreshadowing moments in this conversation. We get the reminder about Anne and the amethyst brooch when she says she hasn't liked diamonds since she learned they weren't purple. She told Marilla that when she sees Marilla's brooch for the first time. And we get a little foreshadowing of the sadness to come with the reference to tears. We have the reminder about the puffed sleeve dress, and Anne was wearing that when Gilbert kept the paper rose that fell from her hair. And it has the moment that Anne realized she loved Gilbert when she thought he was dying from typhoid. It's this very sweet encapsulation of their love story and Anne's journey to marrying Gilbert. Maude is just so thoughtful in her writing and capturing the way that big life moments can really mark the closing of one chapter of our life and opening the next chapter at the same time.
Yeah. I also thought that the reference to Anne's dislike of diamonds is a nice throwback to when they finally unite at the end of Anne of the Island, and he says there'll be no diamond sunbursts or marble halls, and she says, I don't want them. Well, she's sticking with it. She's not just saying that to be romantic. She's like, no, I really don't like diamonds. It's okay. You are a good fit for me, so...
And then the next day, their wedding. They are to be married at noon in the old orchard because we could certainly never imagine Anne, nature worshiper that she is, being married inside a church. Mm-mm. And of course, now that's not scandalous, but Anne's choice did raise a few eyebrows amongst some of the more proper of the Avonlea matrons at the time. And I don't know about you guys, but I definitely felt the same way when we were getting married. It was a really high priority for us to find a place to be married somewhere outdoors and beautiful. I got married in the gorgeous forest canopy in the hills above Malibu at dusk. It was slightly foggy and the trees were wrapped in lights and it made it feel like fairyland. So both of you, where'd you guys get married?
First of all, your wedding was extra, extra beautiful. We all felt like it looked like a scene from Lord of the Rings. So just really something. Well, so I got married in California's gorgeous Eastern Sierras, beautiful mountain range out here. And I remember, it's so funny that you're talking about the Anne's outdoor wedding being like somewhat scandalous, maybe for some of the Avonlea matrons. I had to deal with telling my grandmother, who was very concerned that we weren't marrying in a church. So I made it up to her by saying that we were getting married in a cathedral created by God.
Anne approves.
Anne approved, and ultimately my grandmother also approved, so that was good. It truly, truly is a beautiful location. Our ceremony was on the shore of a little lake with these just like giant soaring mountains behind us. It's a very dramatically beautiful place, and we certainly felt that the beauty of the day contributed to the loveliness of the wedding itself.
As someone who witnessed that ceremony, I can confirm that it did. The clarity of the sunshine made the lake sparkle behind you guys. It looked like it was just made out of glitter. It was so sparkly. And it just like reflected the radiance of the moment. It was really, I remember even at that time, like we just couldn't stop talking about how gorgeous it was.
Thank you.
So cool. I got married on a lake too. That's so cool.
The best.
I don't know how sparkly it was, but we were married in the Santa Cruz Mountains. So redwood trees, all of that kind of stuff.
Lovely.
And Yes, as you mentioned before, I did. I walked down the aisle to the soundtrack from the series.
Oh, I love it.
And we use the ending part when Anne and Gilbert smoochy at the end.
Because, yeah.
Because why not? Why would you do anything else? I remember that was the one time I really genuinely cried while planning the wedding, was when I realized that that was the perfect music for the ceremony. I remember I put it on. I just went,
oh, I love that.
And it just felt like so right. It felt like my wedding. And also, ours was already a vintage inspired wedding. And so the music was like just fit like a glove. So yeah, it was nice.
That sounds amazing. Santa Cruz.
Yeah, dude.
We definitely want to see pictures at some point. We love a beautiful wedding because that sounds gorgeous.
Well, back to Anne's wedding. So here's what Maud writes about the moment when Anne and Gilbert see each other.
But it was a happy and beautiful bride who came down the old homespun carpeted stairs that September noon. The first bride of Green Gables, slender and shining eyed, in the midst of her maiden veil, with her arms full of roses. Gilbert, waiting for her in the hall below, looked up at her with adoring eyes. She was his at last. This evasive, long-sought Anne, won after years of patient waiting. It was to him she was coming in the sweet surrender of the bride. Was he worthy of her? Could he make her as happy as he hoped? If he failed her, if he could not measure up to her standard of manhood, then, as she held out her hand, her eyes met, and all doubt was swept away in a glad certainty. They belonged to each other, and no matter what life might hold for them, it could never alter that. Their happiness was in each other's keeping, and both were unafraid.
Oh my gosh, that was a gorgeous reading, and I love that.
I got the chill, but there, and it's done.
I had a chill. No, I did too.
That line, their happiness was in each other's keeping, and both were unafraid.
The turn crept up on me with the, when he's going, oh God, I'm not going to be enough. I'm not going to be enough. And then she looks at him and he's like, it's going to be fine. It's going to be fine. Like, you're like, oh.
We belong to each other.
You get his panic. And then he's just like, oh no, we're good.
It's a great moment.
So what do we think about the fact that Maud gives us this moment from Gilbert's point of view instead of Anne's?
So one thing that I really noticed while I was narrating Blue Castle, all books from that time period are told with what's called an omniscient narrator. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't need to mean like the voice of God looking objectively down on everyone, but it means that it's just kind of like someone's best friend, you know, telling this invested story of people that are close to them. But the point of view tends to shift from different people. And I love that she makes this part from Gilbert's point of view because it's so much more powerful. Because I think at this point, Anne's romantic emotional journey is pretty much ended, but it was ended when she was able to admit her feelings and relay them to Gilbert back in Anne of the Island. But Gilbert has loved her for so long, and the marriage is what he has been dreaming about since he was pretty much 14, 16 years old. So the marriage is much more his happily ever after than it is for her at that point.
Oh, yeah. And I think that that also is just what makes Gilbert such a great character in this book, is because you are seeing him live out his happy ever after as much as you're seeing Anne. We get so many of these great POV moments from Gilbert where you can tell he is just happy to be there. He's like, and the world is unfolding the way I had always dreamed, and this is wonderful. And so it's a fun book from that perspective.
Totally.
After the wedding and the wedding luncheon, Anne and Gilbert leave to catch the train that will take them to their new home in Four Winds. At the train station, Dr. David Blythe has left his buggy for the two to drive to their home together. So the newlyweds get to enjoy that quiet time together, soaking in the beauty of the sunset over the harbor and joyfully anticipating the start of their lives together. And it's not a coincidence that we also get our first glimpse of Leslie Moore on this drive, and that tiny spark of hostility and resentment that clashes against Anne's radiant joy. Gilbert assists Anne over the threshold of their house of dreams with a whispered welcome home, which chills. Mm. And just that little moment is as romantic as any of the poetry that Roy Gardner ever wrote to Anne.
As it's earned.
And you know what? I'm sure as you guys have noticed, Maud, she doesn't really write grandiose love scenes. In contrast to what young Anne thought were peak romance, all of the romantic moments that happen in the Anne books are tiny and perfect, and the language is really simple and real. You remember how Mr. Harrison once told Anne that her heroes don't speak like real people? He called it mooning, and that if they did, their ladies should pitch them. Anne was furious with him. She thought anyone would just be delighted to have epic poetry recited to them. But we have so much evidence here that he was right. So in The Blue Castle, I know we all sighed when Barney murmurs, "Welcome home, dear," to Valency as he lifts her out of the boat. It's a tiny, perfect moment. And we complained all through Windy Poplars that we never get to see any of Anne and Gilbert's love letters. Anne's pen always trails off when she gets sentimental. Maud doesn't write sappy love letters, but I bet Anne's heroines would have written pages of them. And of course, that's because the romance in small but profound moments often eclipses language. As much as 18-year-old Anne didn't believe Mr. Harrison at the time, she knows now that he was right. And I doubt she would exchange Gilbert's "Welcome Home," sincerely and deeply meant, with the floweriest sonnet in the world.
I have to say one thing that reminds me of it, because the language is so simple in the romance. It's but it if it was flowery, it would bog down all of her beautiful scenic descriptions, because I feel like she creates such a romantic atmosphere for these characters to inhabit that the language doesn't need to add anything to it. It's like she knows it would just be overkill at that point.
Yeah, I think that's right. We don't need these big speeches because these small speeches are just as poignant. So they've walked over the threshold to the House of Dreams, and now we have another small, but I think desperately romantic moment coming next when Gilbert introduces Anne to Captain Jim for the first time. And Maud writes, again from Gilbert's perspective, "It was the first time Gilbert had said my wife to anybody but Anne, and he narrowly escaped bursting with the pride of it." Do you ladies remember that experience after you got married? I remember my husband on our honeymoon told everyone that I was his wife. Like the cab driver, the people checking us in at the hotel, the waiters, the other people we met.
Like, have you met my wife?
Kelly, have you met
this
my
is
wife?
My wife.
The pool attendant, would you get a towel for my wife? He couldn't stop.
Oh, I just remember my old little Jewish grandma, who was like 95 at this point, going, "How do you like saying the word husband? How do you like saying husband? My husband." I remember I was so excited about that when I got married to someone.
Oh, Bobby, I love it.
She was hilarious, wasn't I?
Well, and so that introduction, getting to call Anne his wife, that makes that lifelong dream feel real. I think we've all had those moments that, you know, it's not necessarily the moment of the wedding vows. It's not necessarily the "I do," but those moments that start to creep up over time when all of a sudden your marriage, your relationship feels really real and solid. So Captain Jim tells them the story of the schoolmaster's bride. And unlike the romantic stories of Anne's youth, he spends as much time talking about the ever after part as he does the yearning before it. And the important point Captain Jim is setting up here is that the schoolmaster and his bride had, quote, "a talent for happiness." The end of the story wasn't the moment that Persis Lee got off the ship. It was that they lived 15 years of happiness in that house before moving to Charlottetown. And that even when they argued, Persis said that she was always glad to have such a nice husband to quarrel with. Their home was inviting, and Captain Jim went to visit them first when he returned home from one of his sea voyages. That's the sort of lived-in part of romance that none of Anne's childhood stories ever told her about. Anne and Gilbert then get to spend the next month together, honeymooning in their new home, keeping house, and exploring the area.
That September was a month of golden mists and purple hazes at Four Winds Harbor, a month of sun-steeped days and of nights that were swimming in moonlight or pulsating with stars. No storm marred it. No rough wind blew. Anne and Gilbert put their nest in order, rambled on the shores, sailed on the harbor, drove about Four Winds in the glen, or through the ferny, sequestered roads of the woods around the harbor head. In short, had such a honeymoon as any lovers in the world might have envied them. If life were to stop short just now, it would still have been richly worthwhile, just for the sake of these past 4 weeks, wouldn't it? Said Anne. I don't suppose we will ever have such 4 perfect weeks again, but we've had them. Everything, wind, weather, folks, House of Dreams, has conspired to make our honeymoon delightful. It hasn't even been a rainy day since we came here.
So right here would be where most romance arcs would end, right? Our heroine and hero have finally overcome their obstacles to be together in wedded bliss. So why did Maud want to keep writing more about Anne in this new chapter in her life? She's showing us what happens next, what a loving marriage looks like, and the reality of building a new little family of two in a new community.
As we were saying before, I mean, I think Montgomery likes to keep it real, you know, by showing romance is not Anne's old ideas of pomp and circumstance. It's the little stuff you do. And I also believe that Ellen Montgomery is sincerely evil by only letting us see little snippets of it. So we're always hungry for more.
Right.
I actually found myself getting deeply, deeply, as much as I love him, annoyed with Captain Jim. I'm like, shut up. I want to hear about the newlyweds. I'm like, you need to stop talking because I respect you as a human and your story. I need to hear the newlyweds talk right now.
Right.
You're like, please leave.
Please go home.
I want to like hear what they talk about as they're getting ready for bed or, you know. Maybe we can just draw back the curtain and get a little bit more information about what happens then. That would be nice.
Yeah, exactly.
A little smooch or two would not go amiss.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Like one kiss in six books. I mean, that's just...
Seriously.
It's mean. But so she only gives us like a little bit on their walks and, you know, when they devise to have Gilbert eavesdrop when Miss Cornelia first comes over and their first marriage fight and their first loss, of course, and their first baby.
Although the rest of the book is not primarily about the relationship between Anne and Gilbert, as Kelly said, we only get these little snippets here and there. And the narrative thrust really lies in Leslie's story and Captain Jim's story. We do get to see these warm glimpses of Anne and Gilbert together. Gilbert shares with Anne how he feels about his dream of his calling of practicing medicine, now a reality. We see a softness and an ease between them. They entertain Captain Jim and Miss Cornelia frequently. They spend lots of time walking the shore and holding hands. They find each other funny and they joke together and with their friends. They host Christmas at their home, the Green Gables folks arriving to be a part of their first Christmas together. And it feels good for Anne and Gilbert to be able to host their family and their new friends of Miss Cornelia and Captain Jim. And it's such a sweet moment. Gilbert is worrying about carving the goose. He's read instructions and diagrams on how to do it. And Miss Rachel is inspecting Anne's scrap pail to see what kind of housekeeper she is. And they both pass these adulthood tests handily. I think that's an experience a lot of new adults have, that moment when they're finally being recognized as an adult of equal standing in their family.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Very much so. It's when your parents come over and they're like, oh, okay. Like you have food in your fridge and the house is reasonably clean. Like maybe you're going to survive after all.
We have created a legitimate human. Congratulations. Yep.
I really love these small moments where you start to see them becoming their own little family. Anne and Gilbert also have two hard challenges to their relationship in these first years of their marriage. First, the death of their much-anticipated baby Joyce. It must have been especially cruel for Gilbert. Not only does he have to watch his true love come so close to death in her labor, but then the medical training that is his calling meant that he recognized quickly that baby Joyce would not live long, and he had to be the one to break the news to the exhausted but radiant Anne. It's a heartbreaking moment for them both. They must mourn together and lean on each other. Gilbert must bear his own loss and continue to worry for Anne as she slowly recovers from her harrowing childbirth. Anne's love for Gilbert is what sustains her through her grief. She tells Marilla, "I love Gilbert more than ever, and I want to live for his sake." The second challenge is Anne and Gilbert's disagreement over the matter of Dick Moore's medical prognosis. We talked about this in our discussion of goodness and ethics, the various pros and cons related to what to do in this situation. But from the perspective of Anne and Gilbert's relationship, we get to see the trust between them that can bear the weight of their differing views in the situation. We love that Gilbert, even though he's already clear in his mind about what the medical ethics mean for him, still wants Anne's feedback and her opinion. We get this little glimpse from his perspective just as he's about to talk to her about Dick Moore.
Gilbert was accustomed to refer to himself as an old married man. But he still looked upon Anne with the incredulous eyes of a lover. He couldn't wholly believe yet that she was really his. It might be only a dream after all, part and parcel of this magic house of dreams. His soul still went on tiptoe before her, lest the charm be shattered and the dream dispelled.
Gilbert's still carrying that infatuation for Anne, even though they've already been through the trial of losing their baby together. And it's a credit to the strength of his ethics that he talks about it with Anne, even though he's sure she will disagree, and there's part of him that fears her rejection. And Anne does disagree vehemently with Gilbert, and their argument has the hallmarks that many couples will see in themselves. Anne hits a low blow. She casts up Gilbert's medical successes on him as if he'd gotten a big head about it. And Gilbert moves to retreat entirely. Gilbert quotes both poetry and the Bible to Anne to back himself up even. But though they don't leave the argument in agreement, they do agree to seek out additional opinions. And when Gilbert does consult with Captain Jim, who agrees with him about the right thing to do, Gilbert isn't actually glad because it's not about being right. He does understand Anne's perspective, and telling Leslie has a profound effect on him. Anne sees that in his eyes, and she draws close to him again. While she might have chosen differently herself, their hearts on this matter are not that far apart, and she can recognize that. Not only that, Gilbert wouldn't be Gilbert without his strong moral code. He couldn't have acted any differently, and that is one of the things Anne loves about him. When Miss Cornelia vents about Gilbert's choice to Anne, Anne defends him. Not because her mind has changed, but because she knows that Gilbert did what he thought was the right thing.
That moment where Anne takes Gilbert's side in front of Miss Cornelia, that's really one of those moments that solidifies them as a family unit, I think. It doesn't negate Anne's perspective in my mind, first, because we saw Anne and Gilbert's argument, so the readers know how she feels. And second, because Miss Cornelia, honestly, is a good enough friend to Anne that she also kind of realizes that Anne's statement that she agrees with Gilbert comes from her loyalty and faith in her husband. So it's just this like big moment in Anne Gilbert's marriage. But in the end, Gilbert was right. The truth did make Leslie free, and he never rubs it into Anne, who does joke that this will always be a trump card Gilbert could hold over her head in future arguments. But you know Gilbert will never do so. He respects where Anne was coming from, and he knows that they understand each other. He tells Anne, "Do not become my echo, Anne. A little opposition gives spice to life. I do not want a wife like John McAllister's over the harbor." No matter what he says, she at once remarks in that drab, lifeless little voice of hers, "That is very true, John, dear me."
The last few chapters of Anne and Gilbert's relationship in this book show the joy of the birth of baby Jem, an easy delivery and a healthy baby. Gilbert is delighted that Jem has red hair like Anne. The feature that Anne once thought made her so unlovable is celebrated by her husband. Young Anne would never have believed that could be true. Gilbert teases Anne about how she immediately drops her resolve to never use baby talk with little Jem once the baby is here and ready to be cooed over. And at the very end of the book, practical Gilbert, who has always grounded Anne's romantic flights of fancies, gently pushes her to leave the House of Dreams, a sweet little house that will soon be outgrown as Jem gets bigger and as they hope to add more children to their family. If Anne had her way, she would stay longer. This little home is her heart. It was the gift Gilbert gave to his bride, picking out a home that met all of Anne's romantic fantasies and was the perfect home for their honeymoon years. But now practical Gilbert knows it's time to choose a home for a family, not just for romantic Anne. They need more space, a bigger yard, to be closer to town for Gilbert's medical practice, more modern conveniences for their growing family. And the old Morgan place has many qualities he knows Anne will love. A gorgeous hardwood grove of trees behind it, a walled storybook-style garden. Gilbert knows Anne must have trees to be happy. But Gilbert doesn't insist before Anne is ready. He not only gives her time to think it over, he doesn't hurry her through her grief and shares with her one last quiet moment, just the two of them, to say goodbye to the place that held their young love, the place that held them as they became a family.
That's beautiful, friend.
Yeah.
In contrast to the quiet, easy romance of Anne and Gilbert's early married life, we also have the love story of Leslie and Owen. Now, Anne fans are intimately familiar with Anne and Gilbert's love story because we've been watching it play out over five books by this point. We watched them go from rivals to friends to lovers and finally to marriage. And while we had tension throughout Anne of the Island and we wondered if Anne would ever figure it out before it was too late, by this book, we are just enjoying the ride, right? Enjoying Anne and Gilbert live out their love story. But Leslie and Owen are the big will-they-won't-they relationship happening in this book. As we discussed in detail in Leslie's episode, Leslie's life has been marred by tragedy after tragedy, all of which she overcame with spirit and resilience until she was extorted into marriage by the abusive Dick Moore to save her family farm. And then she was trapped into caring for him for the last 10 years, his mind functioning at the level of a toddler, with no hope for anything different in her future. But we are also told that Leslie has a passionate and vivid personality, full of wit and charm, in addition to her glorious beauty. So now, in contrast to Anne, who met Gilbert when she felt she was at her homeliest, right? She's an awkward adolescent. She's skinny and freckled, red braids, and dressed in plain clothing. But Owen sees Leslie as a goddess right from the get-go. Gilbert falls in love with Anne through her worst moments, her temper when she smashes him over the head with her slate, her pride and her stubbornness in her years-long freeze-out that follows, the way her adoration of high romance and beauty keeps them apart for years. Gilbert sees Anne's intellect in close proximity, competing for honors in the Avonlea School, studying together through correspondence courses. Gilbert works on projects with Anne, founding the AVIS, playing pranks, submitting blind items, studying together. I mean, they truly know each other. They've been close friends for years and years. So it's so interesting in this book, right? Now we have another grand love story, or what we're meant to believe is a grand love story, with Owen and Leslie. But what do we actually get to see between the two of them?
I do think it's interesting to note, too, Owen enters right after, I believe, it's the death of
Joy. Yep.
So it's like the whole cycle of love and death and whatnot, because it's like you have this, you go from this really horrible scene to, and now enter a whole other subplot.
So, and now enter love.
And now love, yeah.
We are not going to bum you out for too long.
Yes. Let's move on, shall we? So, yeah, exactly.
Well, Owen is enraptured from the start by Leslie, before he's even spoken to her. Her preternatural beauty captivates his artist's heart. We've been told over and over that Leslie is sparkling company when she wants to be, adding a secret spice to every group gathering. And in this perfect summer, Leslie is at her best. Her laugh is ready. Her wit is quick. She throws herself into their little adventures. She has finally unburdened herself of the bitterness and resentment that had erected walls around her heart and soul. And in her vulnerability with Anne, she has allowed herself to bloom. As Maud says, she expanded like a flower of flame and perfume. And Owen is handsome, intelligent, and sensitive. And we know he's being set up to be a romantic hero right away, because Anne thinks his slightly melancholy resting expression is just like the inscrutable ideal she had once pictured for herself. Anne meets Owen Ford first, escorting him over to Leslie's when he arrives. Anne tells Gilbert afterwards, "His voice is pleasant and his smile delightful, and he knows how to dress. He looks as if life hasn't been altogether easy for him somehow." But we never get any more exploration of what that might mean for Owen. Like, in what way has life not been easy for him? Does he have a tragic backstory?
Right. Yeah. It's like we get this like little like mention, like a hint of some like sort of melancholy background, which of course we know that's what Anne sees as a necessary quality for a romantic suitor. But then we don't ever actually find out what it is. It's so odd.
I think it's making sure that we don't picture him as kind of this okie dokie kind of, I'm handsome and I know it. To make sure he doesn't go cocky and like he's just this blank slate of a prince. Do you know what I mean? I feel like he needs to have a little bit of darkness in order for Leslie to be attracted to him.
Right, right. He's got to have a little bit of depth.
Got to have some edge.
Yeah,
I think that's right. And I mean, and we know from seeing how Leslie and Anne's relationship develops that they get along better. They're able to connect more deeply once Leslie feels that Anne has suffered losses of a kind that Leslie has.
Yeah.
She needs people in her life who understand how hard she's had it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I was thinking it was interesting looking at Leslie's relationship with Anne versus like Diana's relationship with Anne, which is such a more simple girlhood relationship. And this is a much more complex adult relationship, friendship.
Yeah, very much so. And that is such an interesting thing to unpack, right? We talked in our, like long, long ago, we talked about how Anne and Diana are like friends born out of proximity as much as anything else. You know, we have a similar situation with proximity with Anne and Leslie, but they actually have so much in common in the way they interact with the world, in what they've gone through in their respective pasts. This is the mature friendship that Anne deserves.
Yeah.
And, you know, just like Leslie is set up constantly through this book as more than human, right? As a goddess, as this otherworldly beauty, something that Anne has always dreamed of for herself, never thought that she would get. And here's Owen, the inscrutable, melancholy, artistic writer that Anne had maybe thought of for herself for many years. And kind of, instead of Anne living this, she kind of wants to get to see Leslie and Owen sort of living out her kind of childhood ideals of a romance.
Oh, and if I can take that even one step further, she is getting to see that childhood ideal of a romance played out, right? The tragic beauty and the inscrutably melancholy, handsome man, you know, they meet under tragic circumstances and they make it through. So yeah, she's seeing that play out, but she's also, because she genuinely cares about these people and they're not characters in a book, they're her friends, she realizes how deeply painful it is. And this isn't just high melodrama and romance. Like, this is ordinary people who may look like a goddess, but who's still a normal lady just like everyone else, dealing with some really hard stuff.
I love your brains, you guys. This is amazing. I never thought about this stuff. And to take it a step further, like, and then you have the dramatic plot twist as well.
Totally.
Her old stories come to life.
This is exactly straight out of a gothic romance novel, right?
Yeah.
Case of mistaken identity, the whole thing, tragic backstories. This is the high romance Anne thought she always wanted to live, and now she's bearing witness to it. And it's just like, oh God, the amount of true pain it's causing these people.
This is unpleasant. Why would anyone want this? I'm very happy with my friend-based husband. Thank you so much.
Right. Is this what she thought Avril's atonement was supposed to be?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Well, Owen easily wins everyone over, from Susan by complimenting her pie to Captain Jim, not only by being the grandson of the schoolmaster and his bride, but by seeing immediately the great treasure that is Captain Jim's life book and setting himself to turning it into a great novel. Anne, Gilbert, Leslie, and Owen spend the glorious summer rambling the shores, exploring the harbor, talking for hours over driftwood fires. Conditions are absolutely perfect for Owen and Leslie to fall in love. Owen is on fire creatively, and he thinks Leslie is a goddess personified. Leslie is glowing with life and feeling emotionally open for the first time in a long time. We talked about this in Leslie's episode, but we wish we had seen more of their romance on the page. We don't know what Leslie and Owen talk about when they leave the Blythes and walk back to the Moore house together. We don't get to see their interactions as they boat on the harbor or pick strawberries on their shore. Is that by design? Does it add to its perfect storybook quality by not giving us those details? Or did Maud not think it was important to show us?
Right. We do get a lot of descriptions of both Leslie and Owen that sets them up to be a romantic match for each other, like physically, but we don't actually see too many of those moments between them that really establish their connection. Like, we've been talking this whole episode how much we love getting these little micro moments between Anne and Gilbert. And we're like, yes, that's how we know they're such a great couple. We don't get any of that for Leslie and Owen. And I was almost thinking about them in comparison to Valency and Barney from The Blue Castle. Again, in both stories, we have two people who are maybe a little older who find each other when they least expect love, and people who fall in love despite the kind of social conventions that might keep them apart. But while Valency and Barney's romance is like intimate and alive, we just don't get to see Leslie and Owen up close like that. The most we get to see is in each of Owen's and Leslie's confessions to Anne. Both are despairing because they know Leslie is not free to return Owen's love. Owen is distraught because it's not just that his love must always be unfulfilled, it's that he knows he's leading Leslie to a circumscribed and unhappy life. He swears that it's not just her beauty he loves, but he does go on and on about her eyes and her hair. He tells us and Anne that she is richly fitted for life and that he's been angling just to make her laugh all summer to hear the sound of it. But like, what else does he like about her, you know?
One thing that I do love is Owen's obsession with Leslie's hair, because it's when he first sees her hair down flowing around her like a goddess is when he realizes that he loves her. But this is completely contrasting with Anne and Gilbert's very unromantic carrots slate-breaking incident. And in both cases, that's the instance that the boy realizes that he loves the girl. And so apparently—
Oh, I love that.
Maud has a thing with hair, is my observation.
No, I love that. And again, I think that also sort of is a nice juxtaposition to this idea that the Owen and Leslie romance is sort of the most romantic ideal of what Anne would have wanted, right?
Yeah.
Someone to fall in love with her because her hair was beautiful in this like sort of traditional way, as opposed to the carrots situation, which she found so shameful and mortifying for so long. But yeah, no, that hair connection just is like a really interesting through line.
And it's quite the study in contrast, right? Like, that's what's so interesting about it.
Mm-hmm. The next night after Owen leaves with everything left unsaid and unexpressed between him and Leslie, Anne then finds Leslie pacing the sandbar in the dark, agitated and upset. And of course, Anne immediately knows why, right? Leslie is beating herself up for having fallen in love with Owen. She calls herself a fool. She's wicked. She's unwomanly. Leslie said she would have prevented it if only she knew how, and that she's so ashamed. Leslie tells Anne that she realized as soon as Owen said that his book was done and he would be leaving that she loved him. And she realizes that her happiness this summer wasn't just that her friendship with Anne had reached new depths, but that for the first time she wasn't lonely or alone in Owen's company. But again, she doesn't tell us what it is about Owen that she loves, just that when they were together, for the first time, she wasn't lonely or envious. So,
right. Give me some substance. And part of me, I'm sure that this is not what Maude is intending to do, but there's this little bit of Leslie has been so alone and so lonely for the last 10 years, 12 years, even since she's been married. Owen being kind of the first person that she's been able to not feel alone with. Like, he sounds like a marvelous person, but it's also a little bit of kind of a low bar. Right? She's like, but when we were together, I'm not alone. Yeah. Well, yeah.
He could have been missing teeth and right? She might have still gone for him, you know?
Right. I'm sure Maude didn't mean it for it to be a low bar, but that's sort of...
Leslie doesn't have a great track record with guys. So yeah, I mean, but it is disappointing. Like, we get all the pathos and the grief in their separation, but because we didn't ever see their joy, it's one of these things where we were told that they had this joyful summer, but we didn't really see it or feel it for ourselves. The grief of this moment, you know, it starts to feel unearned.
Yeah. I like the way you frame that. It would feel more emotional if we had gotten to see more of their connection to really understand their despair at not being able to be together.
I mean, maybe it's just because they're the secondary characters, right? It's like the B plot. And so Maude was like, there's only so much time we have in this book, but a couple scenes that we could hang our hats on where we really see them connect.
But yet we go into these detailed stories from Captain Jim, and yet we can't throw like a couple things in common for why they care about each other.
Exactly. I feel the same way about Miss Cornelia. I mean, right. We get it, Miss Cornelia. Just like a man, like been there, done that. We don't need maybe quite as many pages devoted to some of those instances, right?
Yeah, we could cut a few Miss Cornelia and Captain Jim anecdotes in favor of like developing the Leslie Owen relationship a little more.
Yeah, just one good scene between them.
Yeah.
So for Anne and Gilbert, of course, their journey to romance was painfully slow and halting. And we saw up close the various ways that Anne fought with her feelings for Gilbert, the way she almost realizes it and then pushes it away, the way she misses him when he's not around, the way she blushes when she hears his name. Anne is her own obstacle between herself and her love for Gilbert. Everyone would celebrate were she to finally admit it to herself. All her friends, all of Avonlea, Marilla and Mrs. Lynde all think that Gilbert is the one for her. She and her overwrought romantic ideals are her only barrier to love. In contrast, for Owen and Leslie, their love is forbidden. And since neither is a point of view character, we really have no idea what they might be thinking or experiencing. Their barrier is a real one. Leslie is married to Dick Moore. And not only is divorce extremely uncommon and difficult to obtain at this time, Leslie's own devotion to her duty wouldn't let her leave, even if somehow Owen were to try and convince her to. It's not even an option for either of them. It never comes up. So true to form, Leslie closes up on this issue and never speaks of it again to Anne. The best that Anne can do is drop little tidbits about Owen from his letters in Leslie's hearing so she can kind of hear vicariously. But both Anne and Leslie have pride that seems like it might, at the very last minute, interfere in accepting their own path to happiness. For Anne, she has that revelation when Gilbert is desperately sick with typhoid that she loves him and he loves her and there will never be anyone else. But then, as Gilbert recovers, she does not tell him this, and she starts second-guessing herself and trying to trick herself out of thinking that he cares for her. When Gilbert is friendly with her, not necessarily guessing at her change of heart, or if he does, not wanting to pressure her too fast and make her flee again, because he knows Anne, Anne decides that maybe he must have truly loved Christine Stewart after all. We find out later that Philippa Gordon has written to Gilbert during this time to tell him that Anne and Roy are over and that he should try again. Thank goodness. Phil was very smart not to leave this to Anne. And when Gilbert finally starts to propose, the emotional weight of the moment almost makes Anne freak out, and she starts talking about wanting to be able to see perfumes. See perfumes. This is what she wants to talk about.
I know. She was like losing it in the moment.
Luckily, Gilbert knows her well enough to see through that and continue on. And Anne is finally brave enough to meet her happiness.
He really had to like pull her back on the course. He's like, okay, no, no, no. Let's come on.
Stay with me.
For Leslie, once her freedom is realized in the shock of the Dick George switcheroo, she's still too ashamed of her feelings for Owen. I guess maybe being weak emotionally in allowing herself to love him. She felt a lot of shame. And so maybe she's just, okay, that's the therapist in me, right? Anything we associate with a lot of shame, we tend to want to avoid. So,
I mean, shame and kind of like the social convention of it all, right? It makes sense. It makes sense that she was distraught and tortured by it.
So Leslie doesn't plan on telling Owen for her own reasons, pride or vulnerability or shame, about the fact that her husband is actually dead. She is a widow. Anne has to tell Owen in one of her letters about this situation for Owen to even know. A little meddling here that is not even as direct as Phil was for Anne. So Leslie decides that she's going to go away to Montreal to learn nursing and make a new life for herself. And when Owen asks Miss Cornelia if he can board at her house this summer, it's obvious he's coming for Leslie. Miss Cornelia and Anne agree not to give Leslie the heads up because they know she'll run away before he gets there if she knows about it. And when Owen arrives and comes towards Leslie, Leslie, like Anne, throws up her natural barrier. For Anne, it was fanciful chatter. For Leslie, it's coldness, both of them being a bit afraid of the vulnerability that kind of happiness demands.
Mm. Yeah. Luckily, Anne recognizes this in Leslie, this sort of tendency to run away from happiness because, you know, Anne had been there herself. And she gives Leslie a little straight talk afterwards. Take off your tragic airs, my dear friend, and fold them up and put them away in lavender. You'll never need them again. And finally, Leslie can let herself start to hope, for real, accepting Owen's invitation for a walk the next day. We don't get to see what happens over the next few weeks between Owen and Leslie at all, just hints that they're spending lots of time together. And finally, at the end of August, Owen proposes to Leslie in the rose garden of the House of Dreams. Leslie, like Anne, feels the weight of the moment before Owen even says anything. And what's a funny little callback to Anne's sort of freak out chatter moment about wishing she could see perfumes is that Owen opens his conversation like this. Some evenings, a strange odor blows down the air of this garden like a phantom perfume. I have never been able to discover from just what flower it comes. It is elusive and haunting and wonderfully sweet. I like to fancy it is the soul of Grandmother Selwyn passing on a little visit to the old spot she loved so well. Eventually, though, he does get to the point. And just like Gilbert, Owen never utters the words, "Will you marry me?" But instead, he just like makes space and recognizes that their love exists. He says, "I have loved you from the first, and I know you love me. I don't need to ask you, but I want to hear you say it, my darling." And then Maud doesn't write what Leslie says, instead writing just, "Leslie said something," in a very low and tremulous voice. Their hands and lips met. It was life's supreme moment for them. And as they stood there in the old garden, with its many years of love and delight and sorrow and glory, he crowned her shining hair with the red, red rose of a love triumphant. As we talked about earlier, this is a good example of the romance of the moment being in the small and the intimate and the authentic, not the grand and epic as Anne once thought.
Yeah, I think grown-up Anne now would see the romance in it. If she were watching this moment, she would appreciate the deep romance of it.
And Leslie's response mirrors Anne's as well with the proposal, with really saying nothing. I mean, she just looks at Gilbert and he reads her eyes, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Leslie just mutters something and they're
Exactly. And Owen knows. But I think
and he knows.
Exactly. But I think it goes to show, right? It's that little bit of they were already on the same page, right? Like they
they're so connected that they don't need the formality of a getting down on one knee and a formal declaration of love. It's just, we know where we stand. Let's just make it official.
Yeah.
If we thought we didn't get enough from Leslie and Owen's romantic arc on the page, we have our third and last little romance, the surprise engagement announcement by Miss Cornelia.
Which we love.
Yeah.
Now, Miss Cornelia, we know very well by this point. We have heard her opinions on most everything in detail and in a lot of detail. And Miss Cornelia rarely has anything good to say about any man or marriage ever. And then right at the very end of this book, out of nowhere, Miss Cornelia announces that she and Marshall Elliott are getting married. You remember Marshall Elliott, right? The man with the exceptionally long beard and hair because he vowed he wouldn't cut it until the liberals were back in power, and that took nearly 18 years. Well, once the election was over, Marshall Elliott shaved. And Miss Cornelia says she could have had him at any point in the last 20 years, but she wasn't going to marry him when he looked like a haystack.
Seems to me that Marshall Elliott should have been working a little bit harder to get the liberals elected. You know, maybe doing some like...
door knocking, campaigning.
Yeah, seriously. I don't think anyone noticed that all he did was not shave for the better part of 2 decades.
Right. In what way was that helping the cause?
Unknown.
But question, did Marshall Elliott and Miss Cornelia have a falling out? Did they have a romance and then have a falling out over the hair situation? So was that romance stymied by Marshall's stubbornness? Or was it that Miss Cornelia has known that Marshall has been interested in her over the last 18 years, but she just didn't return his interest until he shaved and it was revealed that he was handsome underneath all that hair? Is this why Miss Cornelia thinks most men are useless? I kind of hate to think that Miss Cornelia's progressive opinions about women's labor come down to a thwarted romance.
Well, I mean, Miss Cornelia, she says that she is marrying Marshall Elliott, at least in part because he has finally shaved and cut his hair. So what I'm reading into the text there somewhat is that they had at least some kind of connection, right? Whether it was a longstanding friendship or whether it was a flirtation or maybe it was an outright romance, we don't know. But they had some kind of a relationship. And then, you know, once he shaved and got a haircut, she was like, okay, maybe we can make this official. And, you know, we have talked about that Marshall Elliott is like this like satellite member of all the Four Winds neighbors. So he's always there on the periphery, like, hanging out. And I think that it stands to reason that there may have been something between him and Miss Cornelia. I don't know that I think that she recently discovered he was good looking. I just think that maybe she truly did not want to marry someone who would let his stubbornness rule him to the point that he looked foolish.
Kelly, I think that's also, doesn't she also say that she likes a man that sticks with things? And she tells a story about the man who went to drown himself in the pond, changed his mind, and climbed back out. And if it had been Marshall, he would have stuck with it and drowned. Like, that was a good thing.
Yeah. And even as you say that, I'm remembering, too, that she doesn't actually overly care about how she looks. So I don't know why she was super hung up about Marshall's look. Honestly, Reagan, I don't care. I love these two. I think they're a great match for each other.
They have echoes for me of Marilla and John Barry. John Blythe. You know, it feels like that kind of stubbornness, like it's that second chance romance, you know, when you, because Marilla was too stubborn to forgive him, but, and then he never came round. Well, Marshall came round again. And
he came round again
and he showed that something, he did something to show that literally that he had changed for her. So I think that's what put it over for her. So, yeah. So maybe it was always just like, she hates men. She hates everything. But in the back of her head, it was always, except for Marshall Elliott. So that's kind of my feel.
Maybe for Marshall. And then every time she would see him wandering around, like totally unshaven. I mean, 18 years of a beard, that's extreme.
That's a lot of beard.
That's a lot of beard. So every time she saw him, she was like, what is wrong with me? Why is that the guy I like?
Well, there's not much more to say about Miss Cornelia and Marshall Elliott, except that it's interesting to note that the woman who cared nothing for what anyone ever thought about her or how she dressed the entire length of the book suddenly worries that wearing a bridal veil is not the proper thing to do if she's not wearing a white dress. So I hope marriage doesn't sand the edges off Miss Cornelia. We need her.
Oh, she has to keep true to herself there. Yeah. And may I add again, the hair is a major factor in the romance.
Absolutely.
You know, Marshall Elliott shaves and gets an unlikely bride. So there you go.
That is kind of funny. I did not see the hair thing until you pointed it out. And now that's all that I can see.
Yeah.
Okay, wait. I'm going to add another one.
Oh.
Which is Into the Blue Castle, which is Valency frequently talks about how before she marries Barney, how she just wants to make him shave. Like that would be the one thing that she would want to make him do. And that once they're together, mm-hmm. he's still disreputable in a lot of ways, but he's always freshly shaven. And Valency cuts her hair and Barney cuts it for her. In fact.
Yeah.
God, that book is so sexy. Oh my gosh.
Leaving that aside, let's move into our birch path, and we're going to take advantage of having Kelly here. Kelly, you've narrated a lot of romance books, right? Do you have a favorite book in that genre that you've narrated?
Okay, you can't make me pick one book.
Okay, not on air.
No. Well, no, and I really don't, honestly. I love them. I love them all for different reasons, but I have a couple favorites. For romantic comedies, I really loved narrating The Book Proposal by K.J. Michikay. I felt like that one was written for me. It was crazy how fast I flew through that one. And the one that just recently came out, I think like last week, is Hannah Tate Beyond Repair by Laura Piper Lee, which is a single mom romance who has to go to like the hills of Georgia to help renovate her parents' Airbnb. It's pretty hilarious.
Cute.
Also deals with a lot with like struggles of new motherhood and whatnot, especially as a single mom. And for contemporary romance, I love Britt Benson's Better Love series. There's three of them, which I narrated with a very well-known male narrator, Joe Arden. That one is everything I like about contemporary romance. There's an author named Kennedy Ryan who, for me, really summed up what romance is about. I'm like, I can't say it better than that. She says that romance is the best landscape to have difficult conversations, unpack our traumas, and to lay out a path for healing because there's a guaranteed joy at the end. Mm. I mean, yeah, that's why we love romance.
That's why we love it. Yeah.
It's these women who are growing and struggling and overcoming things, and their partner is there to just help them along the way and support them to be their bestest person ever. And that's why romance, I think, is so powerful for people everywhere. And it drives me nuts when, you know, because I have to field a lot of questions about romance. Oh, you narrate smut or you do.
Right.
You know, like, and, you know, if we love romance, we'll jokingly call it smut if we want to. But I know exactly what they're thinking of when they say that. I'm like, you're thinking of the 1980s Fabio covers. That's exactly what you're thinking of. And that is one genre of romance, but there's 60,000 others that you're not even looking at that you're missing out on, basically, because if that's all you can think of with romance.
Missing out on and completely missing out on this genre, which, I mean, Reagan and I talk about this all the time when we read these books, like the emotional depth of these books is like, I mean, it's practically therapeutic. I love this genre and how much fun that you get to play in it all day long. Okay, so Kelly, what makes for you as the narrator, what makes a book most interesting to narrate?
Characters, hands down. I love to inhabit and live in different characters, especially ones that are funny and quirky and or struggling with their mental health. That's my happy place right there.
So do you have a favorite romance trope?
Well, yeah. I mean, thanks to Ellen Montgomery, it's childhood friends to lovers.
Right. Imprinted on your psyche at the exact right age, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Basically. Yeah. She imprinted on me.
Yep. Yep.
Or childhood enemies to lovers, whatever. It's like those are the ones I can fully believe in the most because I'm like, well, clearly they know each other the best. So.
Right. And we've always said this, if Gilbert was your romantic ideal growing up, then you are set, right? Like when you were looking for a partner, you've got a great template for what you are looking for.
Kelly, do you have a favorite example of that trope other than Gilbert and Anne? Like, are there other books that remind you of their arc or any others that focus on that sort of happily ever after part of the romance?
Well, there are many romance series out there, some of which I have narrated, which are super fun because they're interconnected. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure you guys are familiar with these. You'll see the couple that gets together in the first book, get married in the second book when they're in the background, and while another romance is in the forefront. And in the third book, the couple in the second book might have a baby.
Yeah.
Which is kind of like House of Dreams and Riller Ingleside and all those. Oh, that whole section is kind of structured that way in some ways.
I read once that like having that sort of either having like an epilogue or having, you know, seen the couple again and again in the books, that that is like critically important for historical romance, especially because that's how you know that the characters didn't die in childbirth, which I think is like kind of like a weird, almost grim thing to hear, but it's also so true.
Yeah. I mean, I don't do almost any historical romance. I would love to, but it's mainly British. So they usually hire the Brits for that one. I have narrated.
I wonder, like, is it just British narrators who do that? Or like, can someone with a convincing British accent do it?
I've narrated about a dozen books in a British dialect.
Really?
But yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. But actually, my biggest series is the British one.
Well, okay. Last question is, we want to know a little bit about narrating The Blue Castle, like how you got to do that. What was that process like for you?
As I said, I really wanted my name to be associated forever with Ellen Montgomery. So when The Blue Castle went into public domain, I knew I wanted to narrate that one as a pet project of mine. I did it with Spoken Realms, which is run by a lovely narrator who helps to distribute globally the audiobook to everybody. I would have loved to have done Anne of Green Gables or Emily of New Moon series, but there were so many versions out because they had been in public domain much longer that I just didn't feel like a smart move on my part. It would just get buried with everybody else's. I would honestly still love to do Pat of Silver Bush when the series goes to the public domain in a few years, because for me, that one was basically second to Anne in my heart. It was the first book I ever laughed and cried on simultaneously. I was like, oh, this is what they mean by that. So I'm like,
wow. Okay. Yeah. Well, we're definitely going to have you back again when we get to Pat of Silver Bush, because she is one of the few Montgomery heroines that is truly a miss for me. So.
Oh, see, and for me, she hit home like nobody's business when I was growing up. Like her issues with change, I felt to my toes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Hey.
Yeah. So she was.
Okay. Yeah. Kelly, we definitely need to have you back.
Yeah.
Well, let's start winding up our episode. Do we have any romantic puffed sleeve moments that we want to talk about here? Any moments we didn't get to talk about, but that we love?
I love it. It's not romantic, but I just want to add that I found having the arrival of Jem from the Stork's point of view is just delightful, because it shows that that baby is going to be safe and okay from the get-go. Like, it's not going to be another joy. It takes all the anxiety out of that moment.
Mm-hmm.
That is all.
It's a really, really cute moment. And you're right, because it is so gentle, we know that we are in good hands.
Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Well, for me, I really love this little moment during Anne and Gilbert's honeymoon month. They're sitting on their step and they're watching the sea, and we see Anne's flights of fancy and imagination at work. And she tells Gilbert, "I never see a ship sailing out of the channel or a gull soaring over the sandbar without wishing I were on board the ship or had wings, not like a dove to fly away and be at rest, but like a gull to sweep out into the very heart of the storm." And Gilbert responds, "You'll stay right here with me, Anne girl," said Gilbert lazily. "I won't have you flying away from me into the hearts of storms." Oh, I just love the way that Gilbert loves Anne's imagination and romantic spirit, but he grounds her without dampening the things that make Anne, Anne.
Yeah, Gilbert just shines so brightly in this book. And so for my puff sleeve moment, I will choose another great Gilbert scene. After Leslie comes to visit the Blythes for the first time, Anne has this like little spot of jealousy, right? She asks Gilbert if he thinks Leslie is pretty, and he responds, he falls for it. And he says, "She is very beautiful," agreed Gilbert, so heartily that Anne almost wished he were a little less enthusiastic. "Gilbert, would you like my hair better if it were like Leslie's?" she asked wistfully. "I wouldn't have your hair any color, but just what it is for the world," said Gilbert, with one or two convincing accompaniments. I think those mean kisses. "You wouldn't be Anne if you had golden hair or hair of any color, but red," said Anne with gloomy satisfaction. "Yes, red. To give warmth to that milk-white skin and those shining gray-green eyes of yours. Golden hair wouldn't suit you at all, Queen Anne, my Queen Anne, queen of my heart and life and home." Then you may admire Leslie's all you like, said Anne magnanimously.
And we're back to hair.
Back to the hair.
That is truly the unsung theme of this episode. So Kelly, we always like to recommend something fun for our listeners in each episode. It can be a book or another piece of media, a product or food or recipe, or even like an activity or travel recommendation, whatever we're inspired by in our discussion and want to share with the kindred spirits. So I'll go first. My inspired by Anne, you know, I was really thinking about the wedding, of course, and it got me thinking about my anniversary. My husband and I are celebrating 15 years together this summer. So that's exciting. I did want to share one of my anniversary traditions with you and the kindred spirits. And it may surprise you to know that this is a solo activity that my husband is not involved with at all. Every year, I like to recreate my wedding bouquet. It is not terribly difficult to do because I got married in summer and my bouquet was roses and tuberose and other flowers that are very readily available in July. I can usually even find the flowers at Trader Joe's. I really enjoy arranging flowers because it's sensory and creative. You know, there's like no wrong way to do it. So it's fun. But more importantly, that time that you take to like gather the flowers together, feel them in my hands, to like smell them, to like carefully wrap a little burlap ribbon around them, because of course there was burlap at my 2009 wedding in the mountains. That all brings back those like really potent sense memories of the day I got married, which was, you know, truly one of the happiest days of my life. So I would recommend that activity to all the kindred spirits, either to memorialize your wedding day or another day that's important to you.
What a great tradition. I love that.
Very sweet.
All right. So I have been waiting for just the right episode for this recommendation. And listeners, this inspired by is one of the cornerstones of me and Kelly's friendship. That fancy soap forum in which we formed our friendship also led us both to discover the indie perfumer Black Phoenix Alchemy Lab. They make hand-blended perfume oils that come in little bottles that last forever. Their catalog is enormous. They have tons of special limited edition perfumes that come and go, as well as their general catalog perfumes that are inspired by everything from fairy tales to Shakespeare to Alice in Wonderland to Fraggle Rock. Weird yes. choice, but honestly, great perfumes. As well as more, they also have a lot of very dark and gothic inspirations. So I actually hate to do this to all of you, because once you fall down the rabbit hole that is Black Phoenix Alchemy Lab, BPAL to those of us in the know, you might never come out and your wallet will be sorry. So I apologize ahead of time. But I'm here to say that the love stories in this episode make me think of a few of my favorite perfumes from their general catalog. So Maiden in particular is a perfect summer wedding scent. Anne would absolutely have worn this for her wedding. It's one of my favorites. It's carnation and delicate rose and white tea. They literally have a Lady of Shalott scent that I cannot believe I have not tried yet. And this is the way that they describe it. The scent of calm waters just before a raging storm, limned with achingly beautiful blooms, an icy scent, but somehow warm and mirror bright. Bold gardenia, crystalline musk, muguet, water blossoms, clear, slightly tart aquatic notes, and a crush of white ginger. I mean, romantic Anne would absolutely wear that in the rowboat on Barry's Pond.
That sounds gorgeous.
They also have a lot of perfumes that would be perfect for Leslie. I'm thinking particularly of one that's called The Rose, which is inspired by Beauty and the Beast. Just seems right for her proposal in the Rose Garden. And they even have a line of perfumes inspired by sea shanties called Fire Down Below that would have some cologne for Captain Jim. So
love it.
Head on over to Black Phoenix Alchemy Lab and say goodbye to your budget.
It definitely is a rabbit hole, but a very, very deliciously smelling one.
That's awesome. Well, okay, so I'm going to recommend the Euphora Nourish Leave-In Conditioner.
Yes! Yes!
Their recommendation.
Their products.
Because we're talking about hair, and Euphora, it's EUFORA, it was recommended to me by an old hairstylist we had, recommended to my husband, but it was so good I had to keep stealing it from him. And my daughter had like the longest, thickest, blonde, goddess-like hair, like Leslie, but brushing it, it looks like a bird's nest in the morning. And if I don't want my hand to completely cramp up and want to fall off while I'm brushing it, I put this conditioner in, and it's like butter, and it's literally like I only use it for my hair when I actually want to look decent or something,
like a special occasion.
Yeah, like I'll use it to if I want to almost get that salon look, but not I'm too lazy to do that, so I'll just literally put that in, and I can always tell the difference in my hair when I use that versus like any other.
Wow,
yeah,
that's a great testimonial. I'm gonna have to check this stuff out.
Yeah, it's expensive, but you just need a little tiny bit, and so it lasts forever, which is lovely. Yeah.
All right. Well, Kindred Spirits, thank you so much for joining me, Kelly, and Kelly as we discuss these beautiful romantic arcs in Anne's House of Dreams. Kelly Tager, thank you so much for coming to join us.
Oh, thank you for inviting me. It was lots of fun.
We will definitely have you come back.
I'm so excited for an excuse to reread Pat of Silverbush.
Fantastic. Well, next episode, we are going to be looking at Anne's House of Dreams through the theme of motherhood, Anne's journey to motherhood and the impact of that on her and the people around her. We would love it if you would continue to share the podcast with the kindred spirits in your life. Let us know if you've reviewed the podcast on Apple Podcasts or if you shared about us on social media, and we will send you one of our high-quality vinyl Kindred Spirits Book Club stickers. Reach out and let us know how you shared the pod via email at kindredspirits.bookclub@gmail.com or DM us on Instagram at kindredspirits.bookclub. Be sure to give us a follow on Instagram while you're there. We're always posting fun bookish content. Thanks for listening and join us next time.
Thank you, Kindred Spirits. And thank you again, Kelly.
Oh, so fun. Thank you, guys.